Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, August 14th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's intro is by Krista Case Bryant, editor. There are certain stories that stick with you as a journalist long past deadline. Lately, I keep thinking back to a piece from the 2014 Israel-Gaza war, when our Gaza correspondent and I asked parents on both sides of the conflict how they were answering their children's questions about the war. In this much more devastating war, the questions and answers are no doubt a lot harder. Yet parents still provide a unique window into the conflict. Today, we hear from a Palestinian father of three who can't find so much as a patch of land to pitch a tent ahead of a fresh Israeli military offensive, and Israeli mothers opposed to their sons serving in Gaza. But first, today's cover story. In Ukraine, swarms of Russian drones and missiles are transforming combat. By Scott Peterson. Reporting from Kyiv and Kharkiv, Ukraine. As Ukrainian mother-to-be Bogdana Zhupanya enters the apartment she owns in Kyiv, the acrid smell of smoke permeates her every pore. She's come to survey the wreckage wrought by a Russian drone. Everything is charred black, and the blast, made by just one Russian-made, Iranian-designed Shahed drone, blew the entire exterior wall of her apartment away, exposing the view several floors down to the parking lot. Ms. Zhupanya's mother, who lived here, heeded the air raid sirens and raced to a shelter just before dawn on July 21st. Within an hour, the drone buzzed over Kyiv and slammed into her apartment, at once upending the lives of yet another family in Ukraine. As more apartments, civilian infrastructure, and military targets are subjected to increasingly intense and frequent barrages of drones, they provide raw insight into one of the most vexing challenges for Ukraine posed by Russia's summer blitz. The country must defend against hundreds of drones and missiles launched in a single night. She lost everything, says Ms. Zhupanya of her mother, as she searches for anything to salvage. Her eyes brighten at the sight of several blackened but intact teacups. All the clothes are burned, or too infused with smoke to keep. On that night alone, Russia launched some 450 projectiles into Ukraine, including 200 Shahed drones, 24 missiles, and 200 Shahed-style decoys called Gerberas, according to the Ukraine Air Force. A fragment of the drone wing sits on the bathroom shelf, a reminder of the destructive power of a single Shahed warhead. Russia's attack waves have brought the brutal bite of the front line to urban centers across the country like never before. Earlier in July, Russia launched 728 attack and decoy drones into Kyiv and other cities, a single nightly peak so far. Everyone saw the factories of drone production in Russia, so we expect this more and more, says Ms. Zhupanya, referring to a recent video on Russian state television of a production line churning out hundreds of the Russian-made version of the Shahed, known in Russia as Geranium or Geran 2. Unfortunately, I don't see the end of this story. Yet, if Russia's calculation is that Ukrainians will break under the increased pressure and give up chunks of their country, as Russia demands, there's little chance of that, says Ms. Zhupanya. Her father was killed in the war after he volunteered to fight. A father of five, she recounts. He gave his life to defend his nation. Her resolve against Russia is no less. In our situation, we hate them. And when attacks happen, we hate them more, says Ms. Zhupania, as she nears the due date for her baby girl. It makes me more aggressive. And the gaping hole that was once Ms. Zhupania's apartment? It is an aperture into how drones, cheap, now utterly ubiquitous, and ever more capable of delivering explosive payloads near and far, are changing the future of war. Drones are crucial to both Russian and Ukrainian strategy. Since Russia's all-out invasion of Ukraine 3.5 years ago, this conflict has been a laboratory of the dramatic changes in 21st century warfare, which is increasingly defined by the wide spectrum of drone technology. Today, drones deployed by both sides fight on the front line. They can ferry supplies and surveil enemy positions. They terrorize soldiers and civilians alike, and attack and counterattack deep inside enemy territory. Russia's current surge in drone-led onslaughts appears aimed at undermining Ukraine's morale and will to fight. On the actual front line, its soldiers make only incremental and costly gains. Ukraine is countering with its own drone strikes deep inside Russia, targeting everything from oil refineries to weapons depots to strategic bombers. It aims to damage Russia's ability to fight. Little of that conforms to expectations when Russia first invaded, says Bohdan Danilev, head of the military department of the Sherhi Pritula Charitable Foundation, a Ukrainian organization that helps finance military advances. At the beginning, our Western partners thought they knew war, says Mr. Danilev, speaking in Kyiv. It wouldn't be new, it would be old war, like the 60s, 70s, 80s. Instead, new drone technologies have dictated swift progress away from traditional war fighting. The latest tanks, costing millions of dollars, can be destroyed by just 2 FPV drones costing $200, he says, referring to smaller first-person view versions that provide on-location video. Nobody was prepared for that. 2 parallel drone wars are underway. The first is battlefield use of small FPV combat drones, which are radio-controlled or tethered by spools of fiber-optic cable. These have expanded the frontline kill zone into a wide swath approaching 20 miles deep. The second is the use of larger, long-range drones that Russia often uses to strike both military targets and civilian targets, like Ms. Zhupania's apartment block. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that Ukraine will produce 4 million drones this year, including 30,000 long-range drones. In late July, he set a goal of producing 1,000 drone interceptors per day to defend cities from current Shahed swarms. It's a huge number, but a necessary number, says Mr. Danilev, who figures Ukraine now needs 10,000 drone interceptors each month, and likely many more. With all the help in the world, all that our partners could provide us immediately, we would still not be able to satisfy our needs in protecting the air with this huge amount of incoming drones, says Kirill Lyukov, head of Unmanned Technologies for the Sergei Pritula Foundation. It's a battle of outsmarting the enemy, he says. We don't have any choice. It's not like this is some kind of pleasant creative process. It's just a question of survival. Drone units make up just 2% of Ukraine's armed forces, but Ukrainian commanders claim that their combat drones now account for 1/3 of all Russian soldiers killed and 1/4 of all Ukrainian attacks, illustrating the scope of what drones can achieve. But there are limits. Boots on the ground are still required, officers and analysts say, to take and hold territory, and drones now fly with and against modern warriors every step of the way. Ukraine detects 50 independent drone attacks a day. Sergei Beskresnyov, call sign Flash, is head of the Ukrainian Center of Radio Technology and a drone analyst who works closely with the military. "Every day I see a change of tactics," he says. "The Russians change the routes and the altitude. They're trying to find the optimal way to attack us. Key targets are infrastructure to destroy power and heating capacity before winter," says Mr. Beskresnyov. "Also key is Russia's effort to influence our civilian population because, from the psychological point of view, our people every day listen to Shaheds. It gives the impression of looming disaster," he says. "I see Russia making a lot of experiments. It's non-stop progress. A big problem for us." Already, Ukraine is detecting 50 attacks a day from independent Russian combat drones, which are very, very dangerous, says Mr. Beskresnyov. "They are programmed to hunt and on their own strike military vehicles, groups of civilians, or any other prescribed target. Use of artificial intelligence is being fast-tracked. Russia's decoys, the Gerberas, don't carry a warhead and are relatively primitive, made of styrofoam, plastic, and wood. One Gerbera reportedly costs one-tenth the price of a Shahed, but they overwhelm Ukraine's air defenses and make the same unnerving buzz as a Shahed. It's like terror of the civilian population," says Mr. Beskresnyov. "Probably Russia is waiting for the majority of people to say, 'Mr. Zelensky, would you please stop the war?' It's very difficult to live 24/7 in this atmosphere," he says. "Drones have absolutely changed all war, fostering fear as a weapon of war." In July, that was the same point made by Ukraine's commander of unmanned forces, Robert Brovdy, a combat drone wizard with the call sign Madiar, who spoke at a security conference in Germany. "Russia's President Vladimir Putin has found the best cost ratio solutions for frightening civilians. It's called Shahed. It has damaged our infrastructure a lot," Mr. Brovdy told his audience. "You remember during the days when we were receiving 100 Shaheds per day," Putin was saying. "Well, hey, we will do 500. And we were laughing at this," he continued, "but now there is no laughing in the room, as we average more than 400 per day. Our experience is super useful to all of you here," he said, adding that no NATO country can defend a city attacked by 500 Shaheds each day for a week. He recounted a visit last year to a large NATO base where he was asked how vulnerable it was. "Four of my battle crews standing 10 kilometers, 6 miles away from this base can destroy it fully in 15 minutes, answered Mr. Brovdy. "It will look like Pearl Harbor during World War II. "You should remember that all this technology is so cheap and easily acquired," he said. "Only 10 terrorists can change anything in your country." Recognizing that dynamic, Russia has exponentially stepped up drone production and use in Ukraine. Russia now occupies some 20% of Ukrainian territory, but the 600-mile-long front line has barely moved since late 2022. Russia's growing drone emphasis is evident in a July 20th report on Russian state TV channel Zvezda about the Alabuga factory 600 miles east of Moscow. The footage shows the production line of hundreds of black triangle-shaped Garand 2 drone fuselages formed of carbon fiber and fiberglass. After first using Iranian-made Shaheds in Ukraine in late 2022, Russia reportedly signed a $1.75 billion licensing agreement with Iran in early 2023 to produce its own variants. The result is a growing arsenal of Garand 2 drones and Gerbera decoys, made at a factory that is expanding just as quickly. Satellite images from February showed just 15 buildings used as worker dormitories, CNN reported, though by mid-July a further 104 such buildings had been fully or partially built. At one time, there was a plan to produce several thousand Garands, said Alabuga, General Director Timur Shagivalyev, in the Russian report. Now, we produce nine times more than originally planned. On the factory floor are three large portraits of Soviet-era icons, including the architects of the Soviet nuclear weapons program and its space program. The third is of Joseph Stalin, the Soviet leader infamous in Ukraine for orchestrating a famine that killed more than 3.9 million Ukrainians in the early 1930s. These Soviet legends, the text tells workers, live in your DNA. People are tired. Russia's drones are having a profound impact on life in Ukraine. Coffee cups at fuel stations are printed with a design of a drone in flames falling from the sky and with the words "Donate plus, drone minus." Posted signs beside a cash register at a coffee shop display a drone and the words "Death to enemies." A taxi driver in Ukraine, in Ukraine's western city of Lviv, casually notes that a friend of his, a sales manager by day, volunteers every third night for a team that shoots down drones with machine guns. On his phone are pictures of his wife's office building, struck by a Garand 2 in early July. Graffiti and murals in the northeastern city of Kharkiv depict drones alongside assault rifles as the tools of war. In one painting on the wall of a mini-market, a soldier operates a drone over a field of bright yellow Ukrainian sunflowers. On the battlefield, a single drone unit can use 30 FPV drones in a day, numbers that run into the tens of thousands over time, but are not included in the tally of barrages of Garand 2 drones and decoys. In July alone, Russia launched 6,297 of those bigger drones at Ukraine, an amount similar to all those used from January to October 2024, by one count, and a 1,378% increase from the previous July. 15 of those drones were part of a late July Russian barrage that appeared to target an old, disused factory in Kharkiv, Ukraine's second city, 20 miles from the border with Russia. That strike included two ballistic missiles and four glide bombs, hugely destructive Soviet-era dumb bombs newly fitted with wings and guidance systems. Significantly damaged was an apartment building and sports complex in an attack like nothing they'd ever experienced, residents said. Tamara Tureva, the concierge of the building, describes a terrifying night huddled with neighbors in the lobby and stairwell as explosions shattered glass and tore at the building edifice. "Of course, people are panicking and are afraid," says Ms. Tureva. She hugs a crying woman who joins the partial exodus with her husband and dog to safer parts of the city. "It looks like there's no hope anymore," says Ms. Tureva, letting a few tears fall as she speaks. "We live here from one minute to another. You expect something to fall on you. Our minds are already messed up," she says. "As we see it, they just want to kill us all." City workers immediately replace the broken windows with plywood and pave over one impact point in a road in a well-practiced ritual, but the constant stress of Russia's tactic is palpable. "People are tired. They are more aggressive, and they have different reactions," says Oleksandr Humanyuk, founder and head of the Ukrainian volunteer Rose on Arm search and rescue group in Kharkiv. in the group's basement offices, which are packed with armored protective vests, medical gear, and truck-mounted drone jammers. Mr. Humanyak holds the plastic foam wing of a new Russian drone called Chernika, or Blueberry. It has a mechanism for moving wing flaps that is made in China. Several of the small, maneuverable drones that carry just 5 to 7 pounds of explosives have been sent to Kharkiv. One struck a nearby construction crane. When the drone hit, literally 100 meters away, there was a bar full of people with music, and they just kept sitting there like nothing happened, recalls Mr. Humanyak. At the same time, 50 meters away, a young woman was sitting on the sidewalk, crying, panicking, and desperately asking to be taken home, he says. We need a good tap on the back, so maybe this will backfire on the Russians, says Mr. Humanyak, because for quite some time there were no heavy strikes on Kharkiv, and people got distracted and relaxed, and some feel there's no war. These kinds of attacks remind them daily there is a war, and they get more active. When the drones are done, they send missiles. Among those most feeling the impact are Ukraine's first responders. Firefighters in Kyiv deal with an average of 5 or 6 strike sites at a time, and sometimes as many as 20. At every location, there is an enhanced risk of a double-tap strike, like the one that killed 3 Kyiv firefighters June 6th. They responded to a drone strike, and within an hour, a Russian missile struck the same site. This is a tactic, a pattern. When the drones are done, they send missiles. It happens every time now, says Pavlo Petrov, a sinewy firefighter who survived the June 6th event and returned to work with shrapnel scars up and down his arms. They respond to emergencies, he says, knowing that the risk of a double tap has grown exponentially. Russia's strikes are not only backfiring in Ukraine, but often increase public resolve not to give in, says Ihor Lysak, deputy head of this Kyiv fire station. My son is 3 years old at nursery, says Mr. Lysak. At his small age, he knows the difference between an air alarm for a Shahed or a missile. At 3, he knows that Russia is responsible for this. The only thing that we can see is Russia gaining more scorn and more hatred from targeted Ukrainians, says Mr. Petrov. I don't want to advise the Russians, but if they think this will break us, it won't work. So when we see Ukrainian attacks back in Russia, it's a kind of happiness, he says. Maybe you think it is savage to say that, but this is how I see justice. Still, Ukraine's escalating deep strike attacks into Russia are about much more than revenge, says Inokenti Razumov, a specialist in drone tactics with the military charitable foundation Come Back Alive. From Ukraine, our main targets are objects with strategic military value that are fueling the war machine of our enemy, he says. Recent successes include a Ukrainian drone strike on an oil refinery in the Samara region, some 500 miles east of the front line. On August 2nd, in a video of the attack, can be heard the sound of the drones and the Russian gunfire that failed to stop them, and then a huge fireball appears. More oil depots were struck July 24th, a strategic Russian railway junction that is a key artery for the Russian military was targeted July 21st. One of the most dramatic deep strike attacks came June 1st, when Ukraine deployed 117 small FPV drones that were pre-positioned in the roofs of trucks. The attack damaged 41 planes, including Russian strategic bombers, at 4 air bases as far as 3,600 miles from Ukraine. The spiderweb operation, mounted by the Security Service of Ukraine, had been 1.5 years in the making. Behind each such strike is planning, an operation by itself, says Mr. Razumov. Targets include facilities that produce explosives or drone parts or a fuel depot that once struck, might halt fuel supplies to all Russian forces on a specific part of the front line for a month. There are whole teams working, analyzing, and trying to predict the effectiveness of that. Deep strike has a very complex effect on the enemy, says Mr. Razumov. By bringing the war deep into enemy territory, we are able to interfere with the enemy's planning. Why boots on the ground still matter? Not far from the front line of eastern Ukraine, military drone experts of Ukraine's 77th Separate Air Mobile Brigade are assembling and modifying combat drones to use against Russian units. Wedged into a cramped electronics workshop, surrounded by wire cutters, soldering irons, and hair-thin fiber optic cable, drone specialists sing the praises of this ever-improving tool of war. They work nearly nonstop. The effectiveness of drones dictates what is going on the battlefield, says the head of the workshop, a rocket specialist and computer engineer who gives the name Artem, call sign Rakita. It's not only about strike drones, it's also about logistics, evacuations, he says, as fellow engineers fashion the insect-like units. Drones can bring food, can bring ammunition. The most important is surveillance. The moment we see movement of the enemy in our zone, the FPV strike drone flies out and destroys everything. And yet, even here, where the disparity between these drones' low cost and their ability to slay far more expensive military platforms is an article of faith, there is recognition that drones alone can't win the war. Unfortunately, only the human being, existing, boots on the ground, makes it possible to claim territory, to say you control it, says Artem. With drones, you can clear up to 30 kilometers, 18.6 miles of territory, but the Russians can make another assault and come in and take positions, he says. Drones can't hold those positions. Drones can't perform tasks that infantry can perform. So we still have to have people in trenches on the ground. Nevertheless, drones are an integral part of any effective fighting force that will take and hold ground. The game changer will still be infantry, but only if all elements work together, says Mr. Danilov of the Serhii Pritula Foundation. That means infantry has to work with surveillance drones and be protected by FPV drones. Deep strikes are required to damage Russian logistics, and strikes should be made on Moscow and St. Petersburg to control somehow their appetite to continue the war, Mr. Danilov says. Those calculations matter little to one Ukrainian family that moved to Kyiv for safety a month ago from Sumy, the northeast city closest to the Russian border and a focus of Russian attacks. At a memorial wall in Kyiv, plastered with images of Ukrainian soldiers lost in the conflict, Olina Leontieva adds a picture of her cousin Bohdan Luhina, killed in action in the Donetsk region last year, and another of a close friend of his. Ms. Leontieva left Sumy with her 8-year-old daughter, but the front line of Russia's drone war found them in Kyiv. The nights they spend in bomb shelters here, she says, are much, much more scary than in Sumy. The Russians are just trying to make people afraid and to break them, but all the people who are afraid have left already, says Ms. Leontieva with a wry smile. Russia, she says, attacked the wrong people. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona. 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story. Trump and Putin will meet in Alaska to seek end to Ukraine war. At what cost? By Anna Mulreen Groba. The high-stakes meeting set to take place on Friday between U.S. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin has the potential to create a framework for ending the 3-year ongoing war in Ukraine. The question, analysts say, is at what cost to the NATO alliance and to Ukraine itself? Mr. Putin's goals include securing territory in eastern Ukraine and getting his annexation of Crimea formally recognized. For Mr. Trump, a win would be as simple as fulfilling his campaign promise to end the war. But in this pursuit, he risks paying a high price in concessions to Russia, such as abandoning any efforts to bring Ukraine into NATO. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was not invited to the summit. Instead, he and other European leaders organized an emergency virtual meeting with Mr. Trump on Wednesday to explore ways to exert pressure on Russia, protect Ukraine's interests and sovereignty, and help police any future peace agreement between Moscow and Kyiv. Mr. Zelensky said after the meeting that he told the U.S. president that Mr. Putin does not want peace and wants to occupy our country. Presidents Trump and Putin come to the table with formidable powers of persuasion. For both leaders, these include nuclear-armed military might and a talent for crafting narratives. Trump's shifting position. Mr. Putin has said clearly and repeatedly that Ukraine rightfully belongs to Russia. Mr. Trump has, in the past, lent a willing ear to the Russian president's historical grievances, including the widely rejected contention that Ukraine and the West started the war. But as Mr. Putin launched a dozen of the war's largest drone strikes in rapid succession in recent months, Mr. Trump got fed up. In a sign of his mood shift after reportedly feeling disrespected by Mr. Putin, Mr. Trump asked Mr. Zelensky why he didn't target Moscow, though the White House later walked that comment back. Just as Russia faced an ultimatum from Mr. Trump last week to stop attacks in Ukraine or face 100% U.S. tariffs, the White House announced these latest peace talks. Getting to the table. That the two presidents are sitting down is a testament to Mr. Trump's negotiating skills. Clearly, Putin is feeling the pressure, says Heather Williams, a senior fellow in the Defense and Security Department at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mr. Trump got the reluctant Mr. Putin to the table, in part, by persuading NATO members to increase defense spending for Ukraine and by selling 17 U.S. Patriot missile systems to Europe to support Ukraine's air defenses last month. This was a considerable increase over the 10 such systems Kyiv was believed to have had up until that point. Even as he made these moves, Mr. Trump appeared to hold out hope for a sit-down with the Russian president. "I'm disappointed in Mr. Putin," he said last month in a BBC interview, "but I'm not done with him." This is for the better, says Jennifer Kavanaugh, director of military analysis at the Defense Priorities think tank. There is the matter of the optics, however, of Mr. Putin coming to America when there's an international criminal court arrest warrant out for him. Because the United States is not a party to the Rome Statute that established the ICC, Alaska will be a safe zone for Mr. Putin, who cannot be arrested while in the U.S. The meeting will be the first time that Mr. Putin has visited the U.S., apart from the United Nations, since President George W. Bush invited him to Maine in 2007. Choosing Alaska, a former Russian territory, as the meeting location is both geographically convenient for Mr. Putin and a not-so-subtle reminder that in times of conflict, land often serves as a bargaining chip. As a result, the meeting has the potential to serve as a breakthrough moment, Dr. Kavanaugh says. You don't need big victories here for this to be a success. Potential pitfalls and strategic moves. There is still concern that in his desire to make peace, Mr. Trump could agree to Russian demands that are objectionable to Ukraine and other European countries, including ceding Ukrainian territories to Mr. Putin. Trump could see this as making a really good deal without realizing the second and third order effects, Dr. Williams says. One lingering question early in the week was whether President Zelensky would attend the conclave. Though Mr. Trump said he was open to the idea, the White House announced Tuesday that the meeting would proceed without Mr. Zelensky. Speaking to reporters that day, Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt called Friday's summit a listening exercise for Mr. Trump. This is just how the Kremlin wants it, analysts say. It doesn't regard President Zelensky as an equal, and it doesn't want Mr. Trump to treat him as one, either. An aide to Mr. Putin last week promised that Russia would take part in the discussions actively and energetically. No doubt, European allies say, but they question to what end. What tops the agenda? On the heels of Saturday meetings in England with Vice President J.D. Vance, Ukrainian and other European officials stressed that an immediate ceasefire should be the first step in negotiations, and that Ukraine shouldn't give up any territory in exchange for it. Mr. Zelensky, for his part, said last week that any decisions made without Ukraine at the table would be stillborn decisions, as he reiterated a call for real and genuine peace. Ukrainians will not gift their land to the occupier, he said. Mr. Trump said last week that a peace deal could involve some swapping of territories. Mr. Putin has declared four Ukrainian regions under Russian rule and sent troops in to occupy them. These include Kherson, Zaporizhia, the site of a strategic nuclear power plant, as well as the Donbas provinces of Donetsk and Luhansk. The Kremlin has suggested that Russia could offer to relinquish other land it controls outside these four regions. But the Russian military isn't fully in control of any of these territories. A deal that would hand these areas to Mr. Putin would accomplish something that hundreds of thousands of his nation's conscripts have been unable to do. Russia, which has roughly 3.5 times the population of Ukraine, has, in some cases, spent more than 2 years trying to advance less than 7 miles. Ukraine still controls about 25% of Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. On Tuesday, Russian forces made a surprise push into eastern Ukraine in what analysts say may be an attempt to increase military pressure ahead of the summit. The Kremlin also wants formal recognition of Russia's occupation of the Crimean Peninsula, which it invaded in 2014. Crimeans seem amenable to this. Opinion polls show that most of the population of Crimea and much of that of the Donbas do not want to return to Ukraine, wrote Anatole Lievin, director of the Eurasia program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, in an online report last week. The Kremlin also appeared to use a meeting with Mr. Trump's special envoy and fellow real estate mogul Steve Witkoff last week to propose a moratorium on long-range strikes. This sounds positive enough. The problem, from Ukraine's perspective, is that it handicaps Kyiv's long-range campaign, which damages Russia's defense industrial base and energy infrastructure. At the same time, Moscow notes a report from the Institute for the Study of War think tank pummels primarily civilian targets. Russia is winning. For now, Russia is advancing on the battlefield, slowly but steadily. A U.S. Army report written by a group of retired Russian-speaking American officers, dubbed the Troika and assembled by U.S. commanders in Europe in 2020 to rebuild the military's Cold War-era expertise in the region, paints a grim picture of the current battlefield. Although to American eyes, repeated human wave frontal attacks look senseless, even criminal, They have been effective, they wrote in the report published last month. This is a war of attrition, and Russia is winning. In both Russia and Ukraine, the majority of both populations say they want peace. From these upcoming talks, Ukrainian officials will seek assurances that any peace agreements made will be kept. Kyiv is looking for security guarantees, including the deployment of European peacekeepers to the country and the provision of weapons from the U.S. Russia, for its part, is almost sure to demand that Ukraine's NATO ambitions be crushed once and for all. Under certain scenarios, Ukraine may still be free to seek European Union membership. An open question is whether Mr. Putin will also seek a guarantee to end any expansion of the NATO alliance. The question is, how do you make that legally binding, says Dr. Kavanaugh on defense priorities. It's a minority position to take that step, but even if current leaders commit to it, they can't bind future leaders. Though there are many such specifics to be determined as part of any ceasefire deal, Putin and Trump aren't going to spend the afternoon getting into the nitty-gritty details of how a ceasefire will be implemented, Dr. Kavanaugh says. For this reason, follow-up will matter. In the meantime, analysts say NATO allies must maintain their stepped-up spending commitments, as Mr. Putin is unlikely to give up either his ambition or efforts to control Ukraine, the U.S. Army's Russia experts warn. Conceptually, this war is far bigger than Ukraine, the Troika writes. Russia sees itself in a global conflict with the West, of which Ukraine is but one theater. Neither success nor failure in Ukraine will alter Russia's global calculus. These efforts will include gray zone activities to try to destabilize Ukraine from within and ultimately install puppet political leadership, as it has endeavored to do in neighboring Georgia. Challenges at home. Mr. Putin has promised his citizens total victory, no matter how long it takes. These sorts of pledges are, in part, for domestic consumption, but Mr. Putin is also eyeing the return of hundreds of thousands of demobilized soldiers accustomed to violence and high salaries that dwarf anything they can expect to receive back home in Russia, notes an Atlantic Council analysis by Peter Dickinson, editor of the Ukraine Alert online publication. Mr. Trump has domestic considerations to contend with as well, including his campaign promise to end the war in Ukraine within the first 24 hours of his second term. Facing a recent dip in job approval ratings, the president is also trying to make good on that promise. But in doing so, analysts warn he must be careful not to be drawn in by Mr. Putin's stalling tactics. Putin is a really slippery negotiator. He's been doing this a long time. He knows how Trump operates, and he's going to be trying to outfox him, says Dr. Williams of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. While it's clear Mr. Putin believes that time is on Russia's side, it is Mr. Trump's mandate, analysts add, to convince him that it's not. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona for the print disabled. Next story. Saying women must end war, Israeli mothers take a stand on Gaza border. By Dina Kraft. Reporting near Kibbutz Sa'ad, Israel. Under a blistering sun, a group of women and mothers converged here from across Israel to share personal stories of why they had come to the border with Gaza to protest the war going on inside. The only shade was under a large black tarp strung between eucalyptus trees. Then, as evening began to fall on Tuesday, a convoy of cars, swirling clouds of dust, arrived at the site where members of the newly launched Coalition of Women and Mothers Against the War had set up camp. Many of the women have sons serving in Gaza now. Their rallying cry heard here and at protests around the country last week, after Israel announced it would be expanding the war, is that it's up to women and mothers to stop wars. In doing so, they are borrowing a page from a generation of mothers before whose demonstrations calling for an Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon was considered key to forcing the government to do so in 2000. We need to end this war that is simply not ending. And it's women who have to put an end to it, says architect Anat Mogilner. It's our children who are serving there, and we are not prepared to let them fight in Gaza anymore for what has become a political war, one they are fighting only for the leadership. Ms. Mogilner says she spent a year and a half too distraught to sleep while her son was serving in Gaza as a conscript. She was among some 500 people who gathered on Tuesday at the protest site, which was in operation from Sunday through Wednesday. Together, they marched to a nearby memorial for the 16 women soldiers who served as border lookouts for the Israeli army and were killed in the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack that sparked the war. Groundswell of protest. Some 1,200 people, mostly civilians, were killed in that attack on Israeli border communities, the most traumatic and deadly in the country's history. Officials in Gaza say more than 61,000 Palestinians, mostly civilians, have been killed in the war since, which has reduced much of Gaza to rubble. According to the army, 898 Israeli soldiers have been killed in the fighting. Ms. Mogilner's 22-year-old son recently completed his mandatory 3-year army service. She fears he will be called up soon as a reservist to fight in Gaza City, following the government's decision last week to send ground troops there. The largest city in the embattled enclave, with the stated goal of vanquishing Hamas. I am not willing to sacrifice my son, says Ms. Mogilner, who lives in Kibbutz Hatzor in southern Israel, about 20 miles from the border with Gaza. The mother's camp is part of a groundswell of protest across Israel against continuing the war itself. Of the 251 Israelis taken hostage October 7th, some 50 remain inside Gaza, 20 of whom are considered to be still alive, though in fragile condition. Israel's own military chief of staff has been strikingly vocal about his opposition to broadening the war, citing fears it could endanger the hostages. Activists seeking a release of the hostages and an end to the war have called for a general strike by Israelis next week. After 22 months of war, exhaustion, both physical and mental, of conscripts and reservists is also a concern cited by families and soldiers, and reportedly by army officials themselves. Also on Tuesday, in a protest outside the army's Tel Aviv headquarters, several hundred Israeli Air Force reservists and retired pilots demanded an immediate ceasefire in return for a hostage deal, echoing polls that consistently show around 70% of the population wants the same thing. In Israel, where wars have traditionally been fought as consensus wars, or as Israelis often call them, wars of no choice, this marks a significant departure and shows how deeply unpopular this conflict has become. Adding to the chorus of protest is growing awareness of the hunger crisis in Gaza, exacerbated by Israel's blocking of food aid in an effort to pressure Hamas to soften its conditions for a ceasefire. Wars end when mothers take a stand. Dalit Shimesh, a software developer from Tel Aviv, says the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza is one of several reasons she had come to join fellow mothers to protest. I'm not prepared to send our Israeli children to do terrible things, she says. No one is telling us what the end point of this war is, says Miss Shemesh, who adds that she's alarmed at attempts she's seeing by supporters of the far-right government to silence dissent. Next to her, Hani Ron, an art teacher, speaks of her fears as a mother and grandmother. Her granddaughter will soon be 18, the age Israeli Jewish youth are drafted into the army. I don't know what to tell her. I'm scared that this government will not protect her, and that she won't be fighting for the state itself, but for those in power, she says. Arms linked, some wearing T-shirts emblazoned with a single word, Mom, the protesters made their way from the tent camp to the memorial for the female lookouts on a hill overlooking Gaza. A woman with a megaphone, her voice raspy from leading protests, led them in their signature chant, "Wars end when mothers take a stand." As they climbed the hill, they passed the photos of the young women killed on October 7th. Their unit had repeatedly warned higher-ups that they had noticed unusual Hamas activity near the border fence. But their warnings were dismissed, sparking outrage among some that sexism played into the hubris of the biggest intelligence failure in Israel's history. We are doing what we can. I hope the government will change course. When women are actually listened to, good things happen, says Rafaket Brand, a personal coach from the central Israeli town of Gadira. It's our anger, our rage, that will end this war, Sarah Haviv, a former judge, told the protesters. They may try to silence us because we are the majority voice. The mothers are rebelling. And finally, the Monitor's view. Africans go all in on civic participation. Rich or poor, rural or urban, citizens in many African countries are engaging at the ballot box and with each other. Sustained joint action is deepening democracy's roots across the continent. By the Monitor's editorial board. Starting next month, sub-Saharan Africa heads into a busy voting season for the remainder of 2025. 9 countries, home to nearly 174 million people, are scheduled to hold elections. While that's a sign of progress, it doesn't present the whole picture. Last year, the continent held nearly twice as many elections, during which nations such as Botswana, Ghana, Namibia, and South Africa saw smooth transfers of power. But, says the agency Human Rights Watch, much of the other balloting was farcical and fraudulent. Yet, despite the uneven track record, Africans demonstrate an impressively high level of civic engagement. They show a resolve to engage, to organize, to build, to vote, and generally to speak out, according to Amina Oyagbola, a Nigerian businesswoman, lawyer, and chair of the Afrobarometer Research Network. And this resolve, she wrote in the recent African Insights 2025 report, is our greatest hope for securing democratic, accountable, and inclusive governance across the African continent. Almost everyone gets involved, the report says succinctly, based on interviews with more than 53,000 individuals in 39 countries. A full 94% of respondents were involved in at least one form of civic participation, with the average engaging in 3 to 4 types. About one-third, 35%, attended a campaign rally prior to the last election, and 72% voted. Voting rate in the 2024 United States presidential election was 65%. In addition, Africans also pursue transparency and transformation beyond the ballot box. Compared with other areas of the world, the study found, Africans lead the way by wide margins in working together for change. This reflects long-standing traditions of collective decision-making. Attendance at community meetings is 48%. It's 26% in Latin America. And 42% join with others to raise an issue, as compared with 12 to 17% in other regions. Such regular participation strengthens democracy, says Kenya-based political analyst Nanjala Diabola. Elections then become the culmination of 4 or 5 years of regular exercises of democracy, not a separate process, she wrote in Al Jazeera in May. Even accounting for regional differences and degrees of political dysfunction, the data is encouraging for good governance. Concepts of democracy and civic voice are not confined to educated urban elites, but are more widespread. Participation levels for women and young people below 35 years of age could be higher, but overall, poor, less educated citizens, as well as rural residents, are actively engaged. As individuals across Africa continue to invest their time and thought in institutions that affect daily life, they have the potential to remake governments and societies. That's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, August 14th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for listening. Good night.